and welcome to the EI Podcast. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas. The United States of America is the richest, most advanced civilization in human history. In the 250 years since the Declaration of Independence, it has grown from a small conglomeration of 13 states on the eastern seaboard to a fully fledged continent whose popular culture and military ambitions have affected every other country on the planet. And yet much of this prosperity has been underwritten by violence, or what the late great American author Philip Roth referred to as the American berserk. That is, a level of chaos and aggression that lies just underneath the American idyll and always threatens to puncture it. From the radical founding in the Revolution to the countless wars with Native Americans, often resulting in genocide, from the viciousness of slavery and the Civil War fought to end that practice, and from political assassinations to conspiracy theories, violence has never been far from the American service. Joining me today is author and documentary maker Phil Tinline. His most recent book is Ghosts of Iron Mountain, The Hoax That Duped America and Its Sinister Legacy. It's about conspiracy theories in 1960s America. Phil, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
In your book, which is far from your first work on American history, I think we can say, you explore how conspiracy theories sent much of the United States mad, particularly during the countercultural moment of the late 1960s and early 70s. Is America, by its nature, more prone to conspiratorial thinking than other countries?
I think it is, and in particular, it's prone to it in certain quite distinctive ways. I mean, I want to stress that I'm not suggesting that the British are immune from this by a long way. And indeed, you know, in some ways, you can see this visible at the founding, and you can see the influence of British conspiracism therein.
Well, it's a British revolution.
Well, right, exactly. I mean, so, you know, if you look back to the Declaration of Independence, the anniversary of which we're in the process of watching the Americans celebrate, perhaps even celebrating ourselves, who knows. If you look at that text, you see, obviously, the famous second paragraph talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But the majority of the text is a set of grievances against George III, allegations of a rich array of crimes he's perpetrating, and the suggestion that this is being done in a concerted and orchestrated way in order to impose absolute tyranny on the colonists. Now, you know, the Declaration of Independence is not a conspiracy theory, but there is something of that stripe about the idea that there is this secret conspiracy, and that is by far, in a way, not the only document of the time which talks in this way. You know, Washington writing in 1774 about how they're planning to enslave us, like the blacks we have enslaved ourselves, and so on. And so you can see it right at the beginning that America is founded on this fear of absolute tyranny. Now, what happens in the post-Second World War period is that America, having been the great rebel against the Death Star, the world-bestriding British Empire, is now itself the most powerful nation the world has ever seen. As you said in your introduction, it's an astonishingly sort of booming, confident, powerful place. But something happens in America internally at that point, which is that because it needs to create or feels it needs to create the sort of national security state, it creates a single concerted Pentagon as the Department of Defense, and it creates the Central Intelligence Agency. It had never had anything like that really before the Second World War. Internally, Americans look at this, particularly on the left and on the right, and see this kind of very powerful, very secretive sort of stockade appearing in Washington with these high walls onto which they can project all sorts of fearful imaginings. And, you know, they're not worried about nothing. This is a big, big change to the American identity. But ever since, I think, you've seen this sense of a deep state, of the military-industrial complex, of some sort of darkness at the heart of power, which doesn't necessarily have ordinary Americans' best interests at heart, often actually seems being rather Anglophiliac. And so that, I think, is two reasons why it has a particular attraction to conspiracy theory. The others might be, just very briefly, I think religiosity often plays into this, and it is an enormous place. The idea of Washington 3,000 miles away is very different to London, even if you're in Orkney.
And it's a very threatening place. Right. When I've been there, I mean, I'm not, of course, there's always been that issue of American violence, which we can come to. But the very nature of the country being wild and massive. You know, you're still warned about bears or wolverines or whatever might be there. You're very close to danger and proximity. The climate, if you think about the weather that's there, the extreme weather events that have been part of the United States, the extremes of temperature, the sheer variety that's there. There are actually few places in the United States that are clement in a way, that even that affects the mentality.
I think that's true. I mean, it is a place that is right up against extremes. I mean, I think if you think about one of the great theories, I mean, much debunked, but it tells us something, I think, about how America is distinct from Europe, how it sort of almost deliberately, but certainly did become distinct from Europe, is Frederick Jackson Turner's famous notion of the significance of the frontier in American history. You know, a lecture given, it's the Chicago Columbian Exposition in, I think, 1893, saying that the frontier is now closed, and so this whole basis on which we have become American is coming to an end. Something is coming to an end. Now, there are many problems with that theory. It certainly whitewashes away, you know, the genocidal attitude to Native Americans you've talked about, for example. It wasn't a blank canvas that they were occupying. People did actually live there and had for thousands of years. But there is something about that, even as a myth, that I think is a very useful way of thinking about how America has come to see itself as something that is non-European, almost anti-European, the process of shedding the crinolines and donning the apron. There's a film called Drums Along the Mohawk, I think, in 1938, in which Claudette Colbert, you know, goes up the river, and all the kind of fripperies of Albany fall away, and she becomes a sturdy pioneer. And there's something marvellous about that at one level, but it is also, you know, very visceral, very elemental, and opens itself up to extremes.
Yeah, and there's a wonderful scene in the John Adams series, the HBO series on the life of John Adams, one of the founding fathers, where Adams travels to France, and he's there at the court, and he sees this effete decadent, and he's physically repulsed by this, which Jefferson rather likes. Jefferson's rather attracted to that ideal. But there's that tension there as well between the rational, because the Founding Fathers' documents, the Federalist Papers, they're rational documents. They're part of an Enlightenment, an outlier of the European Enlightenment, hence the importance of French rationalism in this, a priori kind of document, which is in opposition to much that is British or English there, which tends to be empirical, tends to have historical thinking, more pragmatic perhaps. And so there is that tension as well, not so much between America and Europe, but between America and Britain.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, one way of thinking about this in terms of its historical legacy today is America is cursed by having a constitution and Britain is cursed by not having one. America is cursed by remembering its revolution. Britain is cursed by forgetting it. And so, you know, you can never get away from the difficulties of history. You just come at them in different ways. But no, I think that is true. And I do think that that sense of the crooked timber of humanity approach that Britain has taken, this very sort of, from an outsider's perspective, probably maddening, even from an insider's perspective, kind of maddening accretion of, as you say, sort of frippery, but, you know, curious traditions. I mean, what are state opening of parliament looks like to somebody in Arizona? I have no idea. I mean, I think that does have its kind of, definitely has its downsides, but whatever, you know, judgment we make about them, or perhaps we don't need to bother, there is certainly something very distinct about that, as against this sense that the country was founded by these particular people, these founding fathers, and we're going to build buildings and make documents and construct a polity on the basis of specific ideas. What that does, though, is it's a little bit like the Borges short story Funes the Memorious, about this man cursed to remember everything. There is something about literally being able to identify everybody concerned, which is in itself slightly maddening in a different way, I think. I mean, I don't want to call it ancestor worship, that would be dismissive, but there is something curious about the way that Americans talk about Washington, to some extent talk about Jefferson, talk about Lincoln, which is distinct from the way that we talk about Gladstone or Disraeli or Walpole or even our monarchs.
Yeah, no, that's right. I was taken by reading a passage by the historian Tim Glanning, talking about 18th century Europe, and comparing Britain and France in terms of their export of wild young people, shall we say, that Britain was immensely successful at pushing the wilder, more fanatical groups from the fringes out into North America and elsewhere. I mean, there's Australia and all kinds of places. whereas the French tended to stay at home. Hence, the one had a very violent revolution, the other didn't. It's a rather simplistic take. But nevertheless, I think there's something there. But it brings us back to this idea of the frontier, yeah. of this conquest, this taming of this wild continent. Now, I was looking at some figures for homicide, comparison global, and it's very, very striking how much greater the murder rate is in the New World, in the Western Hemisphere, than it is in the Old World, with a few exceptions. South Africa's one, but on the whole, if you look at Central America, if you look at, in particular, but North America, which is, as you say, this incredibly rich civilized society, but it is marked by violence. Why do you think that is? You've mentioned that there's something about the country's founding documents there, about this resistance to tyranny, which makes them armed against the outside world. But I wonder how much the westward expansion and a frontier mentality, the harshness of dealing with this frontier, has something to do with that. And it raises a question that could it ever have been a peaceful place given these kind of competing interests that are there?
Well, I mean, I think there are ways it could have been maybe a little more peaceful. But, I mean, you know, I mean, I remember talking to a historian about this, American historian called Stephen Schwartz in San Francisco some years ago, who said where there is freedom, there is violence. And also where there's the idea of freedom, there's the necessary acceptability of violence. I mean, you know, it's very striking. The historian Desmond King has argued that, you know, contrary to some interpretations of this question, that this is endogenous to the American sort of constitutional settlement. It's not an add-on because the constitution is so frustratingly difficult to make anything, you know, to derive through any change, you sort of end up resorting to violence. He says, no, actually, if you compare it to settler civilizations, settler countries like Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, and you compare it to the old world, to the West, the idea that the state has the monopoly on violence is one that America does not have to the same degree. Now, obviously, it's not a sort of, you know, Hobbesian sort of festival of permanent, you know, slaughter or anything like that. But there is a long-standing acceptance, obviously, with its roots in the Second Amendment, but more particularly in the later interpretation, judicial interpretation of the Second Amendment, that it is part of the way that America is run, that we effectively delegate to individuals with weapons some element of the rest of the maintenance of order, right? Now, if you try to do that in you know, Peckham, that would be an obviously bad and reckless idea.
I should say for readers unfamiliar with Peckham, it's part of South London.
It is, yeah. It's a densely populated part of South East London and a fine place in many respects. But it is densely populated. If you, however, you apply that idea to parts of, you know, North Dakota or Wyoming, it starts to make more sense. But it also does intersect with this idea of the sort of the frontier myth. I mean, the American historian Gary Wills wrote this fantastic book called A Necessary Evil, interrogating America's sort of hostility to the idea of government, prompted by some of the turn in the 1990s, the militia movement and so on, the Gingrich moment and so on. And he was pointing out that actually, in terms of, you know, personal weaponry, that's barely something that's being talked about at the time of the founding. It actually starts to increase right when the National Rifle Association is founded. But when is it founded? It's founded after the Civil War. You know, often on the frontier, actually, there was a lot of reliance on the army, just as, you know, the idea that the revolution was driven through by brave militias with their guns from the kitchen, you know, is a myth, he argues, too. It's the Continental Army that defeats the British, not a bunch of guys from, you know, the tavern. And so there is a kind of, you know, confluence, I think, of the legacy of the Second Amendment, its reinterpretation by the Supreme Court, and the sort of false memory, in a way, of the sturdy lone pioneer that has come together to make it very difficult to shift away from that sort of self-image.
Mm. And I think it's worth saying, without painting America as this terribly violent place.
I mean, it's in many respects a wonderful place.
I've rarely felt safer and more welcome than in parts of rural America in particular.
Right.
I think it's just one of the safest, most relaxed places one could imagine. Okay. Beautiful as
100%.
So this violence tends to be concentrated, would you say, in modern America?
I mean, I think it's sudden, and it's sort of a, you know, I mean, if you think about why, for example, something like school shootings or some of the, you know, obviously horrific massacres we've seen, as in Pittsburgh and Buffalo and so on, you know, what's going on here? And the assassinations too. You'll be unsurprised to hear I'm not a subscriber to the idea that it was everybody but Oswald who killed JFK. What this is often about is one angry, frustrated, you know, young man, you know, maybe with mental health difficulties, but whichever, you know, who is using the access to weapons and the ideas sort of swirling around on social media now, but others before, to kind of construct a kind of view of his relationship, his antagonistic relationship to some of his fellow country people, whether it's those in power or actually those with least power, you know, whether it's black people or Jewish people or the president, and just having, you know, both the motive, the means and the opportunity to go and do something about that. You know, I mean, the idea, to go back to the Kennedy assassination, that, you know, people will sometimes say, isn't it a sort of ludicrous coincidence to assert that it just happened to be that the president drove past a window in which there was an armed man in his 20s who was very angry? Well, that presupposes that the only angry young man in America in 1963 was Lee Harvey Oswald. You look at how he was brought up, that upbringing, the rackety upbringing, applied to many, many people. And so there is something, I think, about the kind of the capacity to take an individual's angst and rage and impact it on, you know, both individuals, sadly, but also on the nation, that is an important way of keeping this in perspective. Because, as you say, the vast majority of Americans would be as horrified by this as anybody else. Of course they would.
Mm. And let's follow this up about political assassinations. They become a feature of American life. They're much mythologized. I mean, you think about a book like Libra, Don DeLillo's novel.
Right.
You know, this is fictionalized. It is imagined.
Yeah,
it is extended. You think about various films that have been made about JFK, but there's also Lincoln.
Yeah.
Of course, it was this kind of moment of political assassination, we call it. There's Bobby Kennedy, of course, which takes place at the time when America is really febrile. When Bobby is assassinated, much more so than I'd say in 63, even when JFK is there. Nixon, Reagan was shot, lucky to survive. We've had several attempts on Trump, who's also been very lucky. How much is this exceptional? How much is this uniquely American? Or because it's not as though they have a monopoly on political assassination. It happens everywhere. I mean, my goodness, it's even happened in Sweden, the most peaceful places. So to what extent is this a feature of American politics?
Well, so there's a couple of things there. I mean, partly, as you say, it's about how the assassinations are then dealt with later. It's also perhaps about, you know, the circumstances that they spring from, the ideas that they spring from. I mean, you know, I think in terms of the sort of the dramatizations of it, you had a very interesting series recently, Death by Lightning, about, you know, the assassination of Garfield, which is actually a botched assassination. Is really sort of the people who really kill him are the doctors, ironically. But no, I mean, I think it's certainly something where there is an overlap here. I mean, very sadly, you know, in the last couple of years, we've had two British parliamentarians, you know, murdered, one in, you know, seeing their constituents, David Amess, and one in the street, Joe Cox. You know, in the 1980s, we had Ian Gow blown up by Irish Republicans. There's a guy called Robert Bradford who was killed.
And the Brighton bombing.
Absolutely. We've only had one Prime Minister actually assassinated, Spencer Percival. So it's very important to suggest that there are, you know, strong limits on the exceptionalism of this. But there is something about, I suppose, partly that run of three in the late 19th century, you know, Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley, or McKinley's actually just into the 20th century, but that does capture something about what's happening to America at that period. You know, there is something different, obviously, to America after the Civil War. You know, the kind of the sense of, historian Richard White writes very well on this, the idea that there is this sort of moment where it appears that, you know, the new birth of freedom is a new birth of idealism, and it very quickly becomes a new birth of graft and corruption, actually, and that there is something deeply sort of shadowy, disappointed, soured, you know, febrile away in the way that America changes after the Civil War, you know, the kind of extremity of you know, economic inequality, you know, rubbed in people's faces. I've been doing a lot of research recently about populist conspiracy theories in the 1880s and 1890s. You really sort of see the sort of rage that's running through some of that. So I think that lays the ground for quite a lot of this. I mean, then actually you don't have an assassination of a president for 60 years. You do, however, have the assassination of Huey Long in the 1930s, the great Louisiana populist demagogue. And one thing that's striking about that is that that seems to sort of play in the background of the Kennedy assassination. Oswald had read a book about, if I recall, about the assassination of Huey Long. And Huey Long's son, Russell Long, who was a senator, was one of the people who early on was very suspicious that Kennedy can't have just been killed by one man. So it has its own particular character.
There's we've seen scenes of chaos following, say, the murder of George Floyd, the subsequent Black Lives Matter protests, the defunding of the police.
Of course,
we seem to see a real polarity in American politics. If you think about the mayor of New York now, who's quite far left, considering in American terms, and we have on the right a president who's has associations, at least, with what might be termed the far right. There's a lot of arguments that we're in a new space in the United States. But I wonder how true that is and how novel this is. Because looking back, as I have done recently, to the late 60s, early 70s in the United States, I'm really struck by just how febrile that period was. You know, we've already mentioned the Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, great proximity to one another, real riots, cities like Detroit, you know, on fire, and really spectacularly so. Even reading an account of the Rolling Stones tour of America in 72 is just extraordinary, the levels of paranoia there. So, and of course, we had Watergate, we had Vietnam in the background throughout it all. Mm-hmm. Real, real crisis. So I wonder what distinguishes, how new is the period we're living through in contrast to that period of the late 60s, early 70s, and other periods of great crisis? Is it that we've become afraid of politics, of this kind of energy that politics has?
I think that's part of it. I think that's partly why you end up with people turning to kind of rambunctious populists who delight in breaking the rules. I mean, I've written about Britain recently for a think tank called the Future Governance Forum about how Britain, and I think this is true in America too, I draw on some American thinkers to make the argument, has tried to kind of drain politics of all dangerous energy, all dangerous judgment, all dangerous life and spontaneity, and try and contractualize it and turn it into something based on metrics and rules. Metrics and rules are very, very useful.
There's something of Keir Starmer.
Well, precisely. You know, exactly. You know, the fact that he's a lawyer. Yeah, exactly. And that's fine up to a point, but the danger with that, very specifically, the danger with that is that you know, metrics and rules give you much more visible answers than judgment and speculation and planning and projection. And if you therefore only focus on the potential costs and downsides, you don't ever do anything. And that's when you get this sort of like boiling up of frustrated rage, because here, you know, people voted for change repeatedly and then had it explained to them, it's all terribly difficult and we're very, very sorry. I think there's something similar happening in the States. So in terms of how new it is, I mean, I tend to think of what's happening in the States now as bringing to fruition, in the sense of bringing into the presidency, things that are there right from the beginning, and certainly go back into the period you're talking about and go back before it. I mean, I think, you know, as you say, the level of the American berserk that is reached in the 60s and 70s is very extreme. I mean, this is the period that Roth is writing about in the book, that fantastic phrase at the indigenous American berserk, which he has sort of boiling up as the counter-pastoral to the American Jeffersonian
so
it all.
Can you give a definition of those two polar
opposites? Okay, so, well, let me do this through the book. So American Pastoral is a novel written in the 1990s by Philip Roth, and it's a very angry book itself about the sort of futile extreme violence of the far left, a few people on the
and
far left.
And it's done through a father-daughter.
Yeah, it's done through a father who is the kind of the high school sports star of the 40s, grows up, perfect picture book, you know, life in rural New Jersey, very pastoral. His wife is effectively working on a farm, has a daughter, she has a stutter, she gets angrier and angrier, she's radicalized by Vietnam, and she blows up the local post office and kills the doctor. Utterly futile. Now, actually, you know, the far left didn't kill anyone, they nearly did and killed themselves instead in a particular case, but you know, this is a particular kind of characterization of that, but nonetheless he's getting at something very sort of elemental about that moment. And what he says is that American Pastoral, that Swede Lvov, this old sports star turned father, that has tried to maintain, that his daughter brings smashing into that. The daughter and the decade blast this to smithereens, blast his utopian thinking to smithereens, and confront him instead, not with the American Pastoral, but the indigenous American Berserk. A fantastic use of indigenous, very important, suggesting the long, long tradition. It's not an eruption in the 60s, not an eruption now. It's something, you know, endemic. And that moment, I think, you know, the mayor of New York, I think he is at the time, John Lindsay, says, I think this is after the shootings at Kent State of four very young people by the National Guard above the Vietnam protests. You know, we cannot see a future for America right now. You know, you have the reports of the horrors of the My Lai massacre coming back from the slaughter of babies and children in Vietnam. You have the murder of the black power activist Fred Hampton, sort of shot again and again and again and again in his bed and then lies about it. And then, you know, the activists have open up the flat and there's basically a stream of people queuing up to go and see the sort of blood-soaked bed. I mean, this is very kind of physical, elemental, you know, violent extremity, all in the context of Vietnam. And I think that's maybe a clue to the difference to where we are now, because the thing that drives the Weather Underground, the real kind of hardcore of the American left, some might say crazy, certainly to the extreme, is the maddening sense of the slaughter ongoing in Vietnam for just no reason at all. Alongside it, as you mentioned, you have, you know, huge protests in Newark, actually where part of the book is set, and in Detroit, which have a very violent response to the National Guard. You have tanks in the streets, you know, the sort of stuff we saw in Northern Ireland. And so that sense of Vietnam maddening everything, extremifying everything, is what makes that period particular. It's also a moment when economic growth, the great amazing boom that's gone on since the Second World War, really is starting to really putter and sputter and will peter out in the 70s. But America is a wealthy and confident country at that point, having a kind of moral crisis in a way. Whereas now I think the crisis is more directly economic. And the midpoint between those two is the 1990s, when, as I say, Roth writes the book, when Gary Will starts to turn to this question of American hostility to government. So maybe that helps to explain how we get from the 60s to get to today. Because in the 90s, you have this curious moment. It looks like they've won the Cold War. They have won the Cold War. They've faced down the Soviet Union. And what happens? Actually, the American right splits apart because the nativist part of the right and the neoconservative part of the right no longer have a shared enemy in communism. And so they split. You have the emergence of Pat Buchanan. You know, Trump actually starts to get interested in politics at this point. And that's when that old, you know, fear of the central state really starts to take on the shape that we begin to see today, the militia movement, the patriot movements, and so on. So I guess, and what's curious about that, just to finish, is that actually channels stuff that looks very like the anti-Vietnam War left.
Yeah. And I suppose we must mention the media.
Absolutely.
The media now is very, very different from that of late 60s, early 70s, when Walter Cronkite could come on and comfort you, whatever crisis was going there.
We're not in Cronkite land anymore.
It's a totally different world. But also, it's not just the news reporting. There's a notice of survivalist aesthetics, what you might call about, yeah, when you think of the Proud Boys and various other stuff and talking about the extremes. I remember, I'm not sure it's still going, but there was a magazine called Soldier of Fortune.
Yes, there was.
Which is very much a militia kind of based sort of militia porn, one yeah. might call it. But yeah. it always seemed marginal, you know, the sort of people who hang out in Idaho or somewhere. But now there are elements of that that are really quite mainstream, even in the way people dress. If you look at what happened in Washington, at the Capitol, there were large elements of that that have gone mainstream, yeah. and the media feeds that constantly. And that's a very different world from the 70s.
Yes, I think so. I mean, the story that I tell in my book, Ghosts of Our Mountain, traces some of this through, because it's about a hoax concocted by anti-Vietnam War, not radicals, but, you know, satirists, to satirize the war machine in the late 1960s. And it's basically a fake report suggesting that we can't possibly allow world peace to break out, because it would destroy the way we hold American society together. And if world peace did come, we'd have to have slavery and eugenics and poison the rivers and invent UFO scares and so on. This is then taken very seriously in the 1990s. It's advertised in, well, a video version of it is made, and it's advertised in Soldier of Fortune. And that world adopts this. You know, it spreads around. It comes to light after the Oklahoma City bombing. I interviewed the Wall Street Journal reporter who went to Oklahoma after the bombing, done exactly by someone of this mindset, you know, fighting his imaginary war against the American government by blowing up children. And, you know, this journalist, Robert Tomshaw, went out into eastern Oklahoma and met militiamen who said, "Have you heard a report from Iron Mountain, this book?" And had this sense that the war with the central government was coming, and they might have to kill the local sheriff who just dropped the journalist off. You know, extremely sort of paranoid way of thinking. But, yeah, I think the media change is very important. And I think there's something very particular that's happened, which is, I wrote a report for the think tank Demos about this recently, and I'm hoping to write more about it, is if you look at when social media in its modern form came into existence, look at the specific things of which it is constructed, they happen basically precisely at the moment the financial crisis happens. So the iPhone comes in 2007, and then in 2009 you have in February the Facebook like comes in, and then the Twitter retweet in November, and those, each company copies the other one's idea. Basically, you then have the algorithmization of news feeds, autoplay video, and off we go to the races. And so they basically all come in between the crash in 2008 and the election of Trump, and indeed the Brexit vote in 2016. And what I would argue is going on there is something quite specific, which is that there is a way of thinking from the 1990s, when this is all beginning to take shape, which is basically libertarian. It looks at the time very upbeat, very liberal, very pro-democracy. You know, likes is like clicking like is like voting, right? It's not like voting at all. It's entirely about the individual's wants and needs and immediate recognition of them. Now, that is not what voting is. Voting is a civic ceremony that we do together, and we accept that whoever wins, that is fair and okay, and we will go along with it, and we will see that person as having authority. And what I think happened was we happened to have built a system which really wired into the basis of our lives, into the basis of our journalism, into the way that we think, this profoundly individual way of looking at the world, and a profoundly sort of measurement-based, like I was saying before about metrics, measurement-based looking at the world. You know, so the idea of a friend becomes something that I have more of than you, but they may all be strangers to both of us. You know, and that, I think, at the very moment when something might have changed after the crash, sort of entrenched that model. And I think that's partly why things have gone a little mad.
That's very interesting. I mean, it's inescapable too. Mm-hmm. It's the addiction of it. And it reminds me rather, I mean, America is the great Protestant nation. It's born of ideas that are Protestant. And one of those, of course, is Calvinism, the idea of predestination. Mm-hmm. One of the things that strikes me about predestination is it's inescapable. Mm-hmm. If you are either one of the condemned or you're one of the saved from the beginning of time, there's very, very little you can do other than look for signs around the world of affirmation. And that's what you're looking for on your mobile phone with the likes. It's a constant need for affirmation that I'm one of the elect, I'm not one of the damned, that the sun shines on me, it's not taken away. And it's a kind of surveillance society of the soul, rather in the way that Calvinism was. And I think it's interesting that that's come from the United States, and become global now. You know, we're kind of all Calvinists now. We all deal with predestination. But one of the things that we started this conversation about the tensions between the United States, the New World and the Old World.
Yeah.
And those have certainly re-emerged recently.
Very
We've
much.
Seen the great disparaging of European powers in NATO. We've seen the Greenland episode, for example,
we
which
have.
Is this new Munro Doctrine, the Donro Doctrine. And I wonder, what are the sources of that US hostility, its condescension towards Europe, which has been there a while, but now it's also there towards Britain, which is particularly striking because of what's being called the special relationship.
Right.
And it could be argued that one is born of the other. I mean, what is it that Americans are projecting onto Europe, onto Britain, this disparaging of monarchy, but the kind of bureaucracy of welfare, of lack of resilience as far as defence goes?
Well, so I think there's two things going on. One is, as you say, is projection. You know, when Elon Musk said civil war in Britain was inevitable in the summer of 2024, I wrote an article for the New Statesman thinking about some of this. And, you know, it was very striking reading, and I paid attention only to tweets of people with 100,000 followers or more. And they were tweets, they weren't on Blue Sky. Basically sort of saying that the problem that Britain had is that we'd given up our guns, and that's why Keir Starmer was able to crush free speech by throwing people in jail for tweets. Now, actually, people being thrown in jail for trying to incite people to burn down a hotel, or at least not even necessarily trying to incite them to burn down a hotel, but saying things which may have effectively incited people to burn down a hotel full of fellow human beings. But that idea that Britain has fallen, that London has fallen, has surrendered, is very strikingly present at the moment. I talked to a journalist friend in Washington who says the contempt he hears from young MAGA types in Washington for Britain is really intense. You saw it before her Something of a Conversion, Marjorie Taylor Greene, sort of just berating a journalist as soon as she heard an English accent. You know, Daniel Knowles, the Economist guy in the Midwest, was said the other day that frequently when he does rural vox pops, and people hear an English accent, they say, you know, but Britain's been taken over by Muslims, hasn't it? And when he says, no, actually it hasn't, they say, well, are you a Muslim? You know, I've had not totally dissimilar conversations myself in Pennsylvania.
And there seems to be some sort of thread of the decline of Christendom.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
This is the home of Christendom.
Yes.
Why is it declining?
Now, so the question is, what's going on there? I mean, I think a lot of that, as you say, is projection. I think America is a lot closer to civil war than we are, despite the best efforts of certain academic voices. Well, not efforts, but despite the opinions of certain academic voices. I think, you know, the sense of polarization is very extreme there. Actually, I don't think Britain is a polarized society. I think it's a de-aligned society where people will despairingly vote for different party after different party, election by election. That's not the case in the same way in the US. But I think there's something else going on too, historically, that actually what we've got used to ever since essentially FDR and Churchill, you know, got into a ship together, is the quote-unquote special relationship and the post-war institutions that embodies. If you look at the relationship from 1776 through to today, that now looks increasingly like a temporary exception. And in particular, if you look, I mean, obviously you have things like the War of 1812, you have worries that Britain might get involved in the Civil War, but if you look at the period I mentioned before, the late 19th century, you see a really extraordinarily intense Anglophobia on the part of the capital P populist. There is this whole sort of theory that it's the British who destroyed the American economy for the benefit of the City of London. Sometimes that's anti-Semitically coded, but the core of it is much more Anglophobic than it is anti-Semitic, not to minimise the seriousness of anti-Semitism for one second. And so that has made me think a lot about what happens thereafter in the early 20th century, you know, the attitude to the theory that the First World War was concocted by merchants of death, Pearl Harbor has been sort of, you know, faked in order to bring America into war. The idea that, I mean, Carnegie's involved with this, the idea that there is something to be sort of, you know, suspected about Britain, even when it is more powerful than America, and actually at that point, because it's more powerful, is quite strong. And I think maybe that has combined with the obvious waning of British power over the last 80 years and has turned it from something that's quite fearful to something that's more contemptuous. But I think it's, if you look at certainly the far right in the post-war period, it's never entirely gone away.
I just wonder, thinking about that, I mean, you've made a very good case of just that difference between the United States and Britain and Europe by extension.
Yeah.
Are there any British equivalents of the Berserk? Or is it a specifically American phenomenon?
Well, I think one of the most worrying things about social media is it may have been primarily of American design, but it is of much more universal application, as you say, because in the end the human instincts it plays on are not specific to America at all. And I think we have seen significant signs here in the last 8 years, let's say, of something that looks quite similar to it. You know, you look at some of the reaction to COVID, you look at the spread of anti-vax theories, you look at the astonishing levels of hatred in certain quarters aimed at Keir Starmer. Now, his premiership failed, but he's quite obviously a decent guy trying to do his best in difficult circumstances, which describes most of us. He's not some monster. Now, there are you know, communication strategy reasons why that might be. He's not established a clear persona so people can project onto him, etc. But that level of vitriol, I don't think would have been there without X specifically. I don't think it would have been there without social media. I don't think it would have been there without rumours going around on Facebook groups. I was talking to a sociologist I know who does a lot of research in post-industrial towns the other day, and she was telling me about, you know, a hairdresser who was claiming that, you know, English was the fourth the language spoken only fourth most frequently in one of our major cities. It's absolute, utter nonsense. But because it expresses a quote, it sort of expresses a truth, you know, it then becomes an actual truth and then it sort of spreads. Now, that sort of stuff, which is absolutely incentivized in ways we're very familiar with on social media, I think has spread a kind of British berserk. So no, I don't think we're immune to it at all. And that points us to the contingent factors which have made it something that has been very visible in America, and emphasizes my point that I am not saying that the British are one iota better than the Americans.
Returning back to the United States, we should wrap this up. Sure. I mean, it seems like a dialogue of the deaf at times between the United States, between Europe, between Britain, something the other. I wonder if what is the single misunderstanding between Europe and the United States that distorts how we both interpret one another?
Goodness. Well, I think one misunderstanding in Britain is that we effectively have a presidential system. We try and think about our own parliamentary system through the presidential lens, which is a great historical irony given that their system was invented to be different from ours. I think one misunderstanding that Americans often entertain about Britain is the political importance of the monarchy, which is actually much less than, you know, just as the Declaration is about King George when it should have been about
this
Parliament.
This is very interesting, I think, in the way that the monarchical republic, right, the United States, France, are actually far more monarchical than the UK is.
Right. I mean, the historian Tom Holland, on the edition of The Rest Is History, said a little while ago, quoted this famous line about America is a monarchy pretending to be a republic, and Britain's a republic pretending to be a monarchy. So that speaks to a certain mutual misunderstanding. So I think that's part of it. In terms of Europe's view of Britain, I'm probably less well-placed to say, but I think Europeans know British politics better than Americans know British politics in the round. I think Brexit obviously has muddied the waters a bit, but I think that relationship's improving. But I think, you know, just paying more attention to how it looks in the other country, not just, you know, from a long distance, would help.
Mm. And if you could change one thing, whether it's an institution, particular political narrative, a policy that would at least temper these berserk cycles, right, you might call them, what would it be?
Oh, goodness. Well, I mean, term limits on the Supreme Court would help.
Yeah.
You could probably get rid of the Electoral College. But I think actually what a lot of this comes down to, I mean, I'm very far from being a Marxist, but is make people's lives and their sense of standing better, because conspiracy theory is always there for some people, but where it really flares up is when people have a shock sense of defeat, losing something they didn't think they were going to lose. That's why take back control is such a powerful slogan. Loss aversion is very, very important in this stuff. And I think finding ways, and again, it speaks to the problems of rules and over-worrying and risk aversion, finding ways to allow more quote unquote ordinary Americans to feel, and economics is at the core of this, to feel like they had a decent life, stability, a sense of hope, and that everything wasn't constantly moving all the time, I think would really, really help people. And I think, you know, there's a great irony in people like J.D. Vance wanting to go back to a sort of, frankly, very sexist version of family life in the 1950s, forgetting that the reason that that was economically possible was because unionized men were paid enough that their wives didn't have to work. Now, women should be able to do precisely what they want, obviously. But, you know, you can't sort of forget about the economic security that sat at the heart of that American pastoral.
And I think that applies not just to the United States, but to Britain, to Europe, everywhere.
100%.
Well, thank you, Phil. Thank you for that fantastic conversation, those insights. Phil Tinley's Ghosts of Iron Mountain, the hoax that duped America, and its sinister legacy, which looks at all those fascinating conspiracy theories, is available in all good bookshops. So, Phil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.